This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
All right, so we'll be looking at Romans 13 and a couple of related passages. And here, Paul says in verse 8, pay all your debts except the debt to love others. You can never finish paying that. He says, but if you love your neighbors, you will fulfill all the requirements of God's law, for the commandments against adultery and murder and stealing and coveting and any other commandment are all summed up in this one commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. So love does no wrong to anyone. Love satisfies all of God's requirements. And so this comes out to be a fairly important passage. If you're here tonight and you're thinking, you know, what does God really want from me? What is God all about? What does it mean for me to satisfy what God's looking to? Well, this passage just couldn't be much clearer, could it? Because what he is saying here, what Paul is saying, reflects exactly the words of Jesus Christ in Matthew 22 and throughout the Bible as far back as the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament, that when we think about what does God require, what does God want, and what does it mean for us to please God, that it always comes down to this same universal. It's this idea that God has called on us to be people who love our neighbor as ourselves. And of course, Jesus, you know, describes who is my neighbor. It's anybody who's in a place of need. And so, as it turns out, love becomes very important. In fact, love is the very center and the heart of Christian spirituality. And in this sense, I think it's important for us to note that biblical faith is really unique in relation to other kinds of faiths that we might look at. Love is at the heart of what God is seeking to build into our lives. It's the central ethic. It's the defining statement of what does it mean to really walk in a manner that's consistent with what God is about. You know, there are a lot of faiths out there and even some versions, I suppose, of Christianity that leave the impression that what God's really interested in and what's really important is that we're being good, that we're doing the right thing, or maybe that we're not doing all the wrong things. And so basically we think of spirituality as a moral framework of doing something right, doing the right thing. If we're coming maybe from an Asian religious point of view, or perhaps maybe a more contemporary New Age sort of spirituality that's increasingly, I think, popular in our day. We might think of the heart of spirituality here as not being love and not even something moral, but rather enlightenment. And the whole idea is to have insight and maybe an experience, and that's what being spiritual is all about. But it's just very important that we understand that biblical spirituality boils down to this notion. What does it take, and how do I live out the love of God? Here's a parallel passage, and we're going to be working some out of 1 Corinthians 13 here this evening, because it sort of gives teeth to what we're talking about. So you might want to just keep one finger in Romans 13 and switch back over to Romans 13. Here Paul says, if I could speak in any language in heaven or on earth, but I don't have love for others, I would only be making meaningless noise like a loud gong or a clanging cymbal. And so Paul here is saying, you know, love is more central to our spirituality, more authentic. That real spiritual reality is not reduced to private ecstasies. You know, as important as our own, the depth of our spiritual experience is, and the Bible does place a real value, not just that we have some philosophy of Christ, but that we know God in a personal and inner way. That's right. But that's not all there is to it. And really, what Paul is saying here is that if that's where we leave things, and love is not a part of the equation, that love is not central to the equation, then we are not living out real biblical spirituality. Then he goes on in verse 2 and he says, if I had the gift of prophecy, and if I knew all the mysteries in the future and knew everything about everything, but didn't have love for others, what good would I be? Well, I take umbrage with that comment because I think knowing lots of things, and I would really like to know everything about everything. But Paul says here, look, even if you did know everything about everything and you didn't have real love for other people, you wouldn't be any good. Useless. Real spiritual depth is not defined in terms of deeper knowledge. Does that mean knowledge doesn't matter? No, he's not saying that. Knowledge does matter. But knowledge is not enough. It's not enough to know about God. It's not enough to have deep experiences with God. If these things are not translated then into concrete and practical expressions of love, well, then they just don't do any good at all. Then Paul goes on, he says, and if I had the gift of faith so that I could speak to a mountain and it would move, without love, I would be no good to anybody. And so here again, you know, even if I just had the most earnest and sincere and fervent faith in God, but this was not translating over into concrete love for others, then spiritual reality cannot be measured by the depth of my personal faith. It just becomes something very private, very individual, completely useless to everyone around me. I think pretty much what Paul has described up to this point is a picture of American spirituality. The focus is on ourselves, my experience, the things that I'm learning, the acts of faith that I live out so that God can enhance my world. And Paul's saying that's not enough, and that's not at the heart of things. Look, he goes even further in verse 3. He says, if I give everything I have to the poor and even sacrifice my body, I could boast about it, but if I didn't love others, it would be of no value at all. That's really a striking thing. It's possible to actually sacrifice a lot of who I am, to sacrifice maybe even my very life. But if that sacrifice is not shrouded in the love of God, it's a completely worthless thing. I don't know, I mean, some of us are probably old enough that we can remember during the Vietnam War, on the streets of Saigon, where you had these Buddhist monks burning themselves alive in protest against the war. And you know, maybe that point of view that they had was the right point of view. That's a matter of some debate, I suppose. But no one could say that they weren't fervent about their belief and that they sacrificed everything in support of it. But that doesn't do anything. It didn't stop anything. It didn't make any difference to anyone. It wasn't a concrete act of love, even though it was obviously a supreme act of self-sacrifice. Those are two, not one and the same thing, ultimate sacrifice and real love. And so Paul is really saying that all of the conceptions that are popular about spirituality, our depth of experience, the depth of our knowledge, the fervence of our faith, the fact that we perhaps are even willing to die for what we believe, none of these things really add up to the real heart of what God is trying to accomplish in our lives, the thing that matters to Him, which is that we are people of love. And so we want to talk about this idea of biblical love here tonight and consider a couple of different propositions and why love, from the Bible's point of view, really is at the center of what matters to God. We note first that love is a basic human need. Maybe love is the most basic of all human needs. Maybe it's the experience and the need for love, in fact, that more than anything else distinguishes ourselves from all other life forms. Human beings need love. Human beings need to be accepted for who they are. We need to be valued. We need to be cared for. And, you know, like, for instance, if you study criminology, you will note that there is a very high correlation between violent criminals and people who were raised in households in which there was not a loving, often male figure in that household. The sense of rage and anger, the lack of self-control, things like that that so typify hardened criminals is something that really emerges out often, not independent, of course, of their own moral choices along the way, but the emotional frame, the psychological frame of mind for the vast majority of criminals comes as a consequence of not experiencing something that all human beings desperately need in their lives. And of course, all of us have grown up to one extent or another in families in which love was not perfect. And to that extent, maybe we are paying the dues even in our adult life for the imbalances that are there and so forth. And that's an interesting thought, and it's probably worthy of a night's discussion, but not tonight's. My point simply is that it is a need to be loved. It's a deep, profound human thing, a personal thing to experience love. And the question that we want to get at right here is not whether or not love is central to the basic human good, but rather, where do we seek it? Where do we seek for love? That's an important question. You know, you watch TV and, you know, they have all those dot-coms that are trying to sell you, a relationship. And, you know, you click in, I suppose. I've never done this, but I'm guessing that you just, you know, you're looking for the right profile. You want to find just the right person because, you know, the idea is then you'll get some kind of chemistry thing and live happily ever after. At least that's what the commercials say. Finding the right person. That person who is going to love me and that I'm compatible with. But, you know, there's a real problem and a downside to this whole quest that so preoccupies modern culture, finding the right person. And the dilemma is the enormous pressure that comes on another person who has the same need that you do. And this is why the quest for love relationships that last in our culture is one of the most galling and unresolvable problems that we face. Marriage and long-term monogamous relationships are simply not working in our society today. With a divorce rate of about 50%, which is actually down a little bit from a decade or two ago, and the reason is because many people, as they're emerging to the marriageable years, have just abandoned the idea of marriage altogether. They're cohabitating. But of course, the statistics on successful cohabitation relationships is even worse than for divorce. We've got a real problem on our hands because we're seeking to find the right person. We want to mesh with that person. We want to have that experience of love where we have that acceptance from another. We're valued by that person. We're genuinely cared for. But they have the same need that we do. And it creates this problem where we've got competing needs and competing values. I want you to put me first. See? But then you're saying, on the other hand, yeah, but I want you to put me first. And how can this be? We've got a contradiction on our hands. You know, strong romantic attraction is not enough to sustain you through the stress of loving unlovely people. Our culture believes, you know, in the ultimate power of romantic love to just put the pieces of my life together. But I guess for most of us who've been married for more than a few weeks, we know that that these are things that ebb and flow. And that, you know, while maybe we're dating, we're on our best behavior and putting that best foot forward and stuff, but it doesn't take long in that marriage relationship to begin to see that other person, warts and all, with all of their limitations, with all their deficiencies, with all their selfishness, with all those things that rob us of what we so desperately need, that unconditional acceptance, that value, that sense of being cared for above all others. Look, here's the issue. We need to ask, what is the foundation for a real love relationship? That's the question that we need to think about, whether it's in the context of marriage or parenting or with our coworkers, with our neighbors, whatever it is. What is the foundation of relationships that really work? That's what we want to get into. And, you know, here the Bible does speak with some authority and with some power. In 1 John 4, verses 8 and 9, John says, look, it comes down to this. Do we want to know what love is? Love is not a chemical that just shoots off at some brain centers that makes us act and feel a certain kind of way. God, he says, is love. God is love. Love is inherently personal. It comes from the very person of God. And he says, by this, the love of God was made known to us. So not only do we have a basis for love, that there is in the workings of reality, because God is there, a real basis for love, but we can know what that love is. Namely, he says, that God sent his only begotten Son into the world so that we might live through him. So now love goes beyond merely a feeling and into the range of real content, real meaning, real significance. What is love? Well, love, he says, is wrapped up in what God did through his Son. You know, that very famous verse in not 1 John, but in the Gospel of John, chapter 3, verse 16, where he says that God loved the world so much that he loved you so much that he gave everything he had. He gave his Son. So now we come to the real heart of what love is. Not a chemistry that happens between people. Not a feeling state. It is the act of giving to the pressing and real needs of other people. That's at the heart of it. What is our real need that God gave everything he had to meet? Our real need is to be reconciled with God. Our real need is to recognize, you know, I'm not like God. I do realize, in fact, that I've really gone my own way with my life. I've gone my own course, done my own thing, made my own mistakes. Yeah, no, I don't really have something real going with God. Because my thing's really not his thing. And that's what the Bible, you know, just basically calls sin. That's what sin is. We're all this way. And that sin alienates us from God. And the only way for us to be able to then come back into a relationship with God, to have real needs met at the core of our being, to become alive to him spiritually, and to experience his love for us, is for us to say, okay, that death that you died for me, Christ on the cross, you, the everything that God could have given, that death was the death that I deserve. And I am willing now to say, I can come to you, God, through on the basis of what Christ has done for me on the cross. I accept your death for me. That demonstration of love, I understand to be the basis for real forgiveness and reconciliation between me and you. And I'm just coming to you, God, saying that that's what I want. And the Bible says in the moment that we interact with God in this way, that we will come into that relationship with God, we'll begin to experience his love in a personal way. This is really the heart of the Bible's message from beginning to end. The Bible is simply the story of how God etched his plan to give everything that he had into the pages of history. So that we could look back and say, sure enough, man, God was there all along through making predictions, through raising a nation to bring his Son into the world, all these things, so that we could be sure and have a real stable, objective foundation to be able to say, God does love us, and that God did give us everything that he had to give. You know, here's the question that some of us maybe need to interact with here tonight. Why not share in God's love? Why not realize that we're at that point in our own lives where we cannot extract love from other people and really think that that's going to work, because it doesn't work, and we know that doesn't work. Why don't we realize that we're at that point, that no matter what I do, the successes that I have, the experiences in life that I have, somehow they're never enough, and they don't produce that awareness, that real knowledge of my acceptability, my value, the fact that I'm unconditionally cared for by another, those things that we know that we really do need in our lives. Why not take this moment and just acknowledge these things to God and say, I've been putting all kinds of things in the place that only you belong in my life. And just invite Christ to come in and take that place. That would be really cool. And if we do that, then we're in a position to then really be thinking about experiencing the love of God in a fundamentally different way, in a profound way, in a life-changing way. Second thing that we want to consider here tonight is the notion of experiencing love is based, paradoxically, not on what we receive. But if we've got Christ in our lives, if we're alive to God through the Spirit who indwells us, then our experience of love is rooted then and occurs in the act of giving the love that God has given to us. Here's what Jesus says. This is on the last night of his life as he's just speaking in the shadow of the cross. He says in John 15, he says, I have spoken to you, my disciples, that my joy may be in you. You know, I want you to experience real joy in your life. And that your joy may be made full. And this is my command, that you love one another just as I have loved you. Now, that's a pretty wild passage when you think about it. I want you to have deep, profound joy in your life. And you will experience real joy in your life when you love. And how do we love? Just as I have loved you. Well, how does Christ love us? He laid down his life for us. He sacrificed everything he had to meet our fundamental need. And the promise of this passage, which is just echoed throughout the New Testament, is that if our lives more and more are poured out and directed toward laying aside my rights, my needs, my interests, and seeking after the real good and the interest of other people. In other words, real love. That we will experience joy. That's a pretty cool thought. That's what the Bible teaches. And that leaves us then with just a couple of things to consider here. The first would be, for those of us tonight here who do know Christ, are you convinced that Christ-like love is where true joy is found? Do we think, just like the rest of the culture around us, that, you know, what's really going to scratch my itch is what I get out there for me? When things are moving my way, when circumstances are favorable to my initiatives, my objectives, my comfort, my success. Have we really bought into the clear teaching of Scripture? Are we convinced that it's actually by laying down our lives, surrendering our prerogatives to go it my own way, and to live as a servant of God in the lives of other people, that I'm going to find a deeper, satisfying joy than anything that I could possibly achieve or get on my own? And you know, frankly, this is just a question that we're going to have resolved in our minds. Because this is the crossroads of spirituality at this point. Do we agree with God here? Or are we still seeking our own way? And here's another thing that kind of goes with this. Will you allow the demands of Christ-like love to redefine your relationships and to revolutionize your spiritual life? These are very simple questions, vexing in their simplicity, because they get right to the core of what motivates me, what drives me, what I'm looking for in life. And so when we're thinking about, you know, what is God trying to do in my life? Where does God want me to go from here? It really comes down to these questions at this point. And there's very little point as we think about our spiritual lives and going much further beyond this until we've got an answer to those questions. This is crucial. Now, let's think about this then in very practical terms, staying in our passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Here's a passage that we've almost all heard, regardless of our background, because this is what they read at weddings. So let's go to that. We continue on, verse 4. Here he says, love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. Love does not demand its own way. Love is not irritable. It keeps no record of when it has been wronged. It is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance. So what kind of person does God want you to be more and more in your life? Right here. This. We get this in the bag, we're doing pretty well. Let's think about this just a little bit. I want to break this down more or less into three categories. We've got this big list, but what is it really all saying? It's saying first that there is a spiritual dimension to love that is really at the heart and which makes love relationships really work. What does he say? Keeps no record of when it has been wronged. The real problem that we're having in love relationships is that we think of them more or less in terms of a contract. You do your part, I do mine, we meet in the middle. When you fail, you owe me. You owe me. You're in my debt. And so maybe you can work your way out of that debt somehow. I don't know, maybe you can't. But that's the point, is that we're both supposed to be doing our part, and where one or both of the parties fail to keep their part, then the other has the right to say the contract has been violated and we move on. A contractually based relationship. It's what the Bible calls living by the law. A standard of performance that is required to maintain a relationship. And the Bible is against that, because that's not the way God is. You see, God has not treated us on the basis of a contract. It's not a give-and-take relationship. He hasn't met us halfway. God has met us the whole way. That's what grace is. It's unmerited favor. It's for the undeserving. That's what grace means. That's the way God loves us. And as a consequence, at the very heart of love, he's saying, that is how you now turn around, and that's how you look at the relationships in your life. Don't stand there and say, I accept the unmerited favor of God, and then turn around and demand of your spouse, of your child, of your parent, of your neighbor, of your work associate, that they earn by their performance your acceptance. That's hypocrisy. And Paul here is saying, look, our ability to love is based upon the fact that we have been loved by God. And this is why I think outside of a relationship with God, where there's a real spiritual foundation, this is why relationships don't work in a deep way and in an enduring way. Because there is no basis to reconcile fundamental differences between people to really live out grace and forgiveness in those relationships. This passage is a call for humility. This is a passage that says, I don't want to keep a record of your wrongs against me. Why should I do that? Because, you know, look, if you keep a tab of my wrongs against you, I'm in desperate trouble. See, I have to look at that other person who sinned against me to say, I'm just that way myself. I'm that way. So real love means humility. Humility that I don't deserve love any more than you do. It's a call for genuine forgiveness from the heart. To say, I give up the right to retaliate and to hold your behavior over your head to punish you for the things that you have done. And then he says in verse 7, love never gives up. Love never loses faith. Love is always hopeful. Man, I wonder if love is ignorant. I wonder if love doesn't really know me very well. Now, what he's saying is that love trusts that God doesn't quit on people. That's right. God never gives up. God never loses faith. God is always hopeful because when a person comes into a relationship with him, it's permanent. It's fixed. It's done. And that then offers us a little bit of hope when we begin to interact with the very unperfect people in our lives, the people whose lives are under construction, perpetually under construction, really under construction, and we are, wondering, how can I possibly love this person? Well, God does. See, and I was thinking about this today as I was preparing. You think about the parable of the prodigal son from a lot of different perspectives. You think about the son who goes out there and he gets his inheritance and he leaves to the faraway land. And what does he do? He squanders all he has, ends up living like a pig, and then crawling, sniveling back to his father. Well, you can think about it, too, from the standpoint of the older brother who's high and mighty and self-righteous and I never did anything like that. And so there's a message there too about arrogance and humility. But I think this passage brings out in that parable another thing, which is the prodigal father's long watch. And when you love people more than you love yourself and you see them going the wrong way, it takes everything in your being not to give up. Because it hurts to see people walking away from the sphere of your love and of your care. And the father of that parable tells us, we don't give up on people. We don't just write people off and say, okay, the hell with you. Do it your way. Forget it. It doesn't lose faith, not in that person, but in God. Because even that person who's walking away from the sphere of your love and maybe walking away from a spiritual life is a person who's going to take that with them. And God is not going to let that person run from him because it's not possible to do so. And there's always a basis for hope. There's always a basis for hope in a relationship if we have this foundation. This passage urges us to take the long view with people. Are you impatient? I'm impatient. And when I am not seeing the results that I want to see in my key relationships, I find myself very frustrated, sometimes given to anger over those relationships, especially around the house. And this passage says we need to take the long view of people, that it takes, there's processes that people are involved with, that God is involved in that process. It's going to take time to work through, to come to the kind of convictions, to make decisions, to get back on track in the relationship and with God. And we've got to have that long view of people. Indeed, we need to view as Christians people from the end. And this is the only way I think we can have that kind of endurance that he describes here. If I don't see that one in my life who I love but is difficult to love from the standpoint not of who they are today, but who they will be in the presence of Christ, whole, healed, put together the way God intended for them to be, then it's extremely difficult for me to have the motivation to continue to press towards them now. I know there's an end in sight. I know what they will be. And because I know what they will be, I will risk, I will give, I will sacrifice. I will continue to be invested in them because they are God's child. Love does not fail. So there's a spiritual dimension to love. It's really at the core. But there is a moral dimension as well, and Paul brings out some of this. Love is not jealous. It means that it's not possessive or exclusive. And you see that in kids. Kids are super mean, along these lines. And so you got the in group and the out group defined, of course, in very different terms. And we're zealous for the people that are within our little fold. But the people who are outside that fold, they're a drag. They're gross. They're, whatever label we want to put on them. Well, adults are the same way. We are like this. And we love those who love us. We love those who are like us. We're very selective about our love. And very possessive, very exclusive. And love is not that way. Love is inclusive. God loves the whole world. God doesn't make divisions between people. There's no such thing as a person who is so weird or so aberrant or so whatever it is to be outside the scope of God's love. And so similarly, no one should be outside the scope of our love either. Love is not boastful or prideful. There's no place for self-serving ego in relationships. The shallow competitiveness that so defines relationships between people. And my relationship with my colleague at work or whatever is that I'm going to show them that I'm really better, that I'm more deserving of the raise, of climb up the ladder, or whatever it is. We're very competitive in our relationships, very boastful, very prideful, and that's very uncool. Because love is not about a competition. Love is a cooperation between people. Love is a commitment, regardless of their commitment to me, to them and to their good. So there's no place to be boastful. There's no place for pride in our relationships with others. And then he goes on, here's verse 6, he says, love is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. I like the way that's worded. I think that's really kind of cool. And it really offers itself as a contrast to the fact that love never fails, that love is always hopeful, that love doesn't give up. And it tells us that, yes, love does not give up, but love is grieved by moral failure because it fractures the trust in relationships. It damages people. Love is an intensely moral thing. And so love is going to involve discipline where moral failure is involved. I can, on the one hand, hope for God's work to be accomplished in your life, and at the same time, bring real consequences to bear on your moral failure. In this sense, love's not a doormat. It doesn't serve the real interests of another person just to be, whatever, as a person annihilates everyone in their path, including themselves. Love can be very tough. Love must be very tough. If we're unwilling to bring moral pressure to bear on the moral failings of others, then we are basically co-conspiring in their destruction. It's not love. And so I'm unequivocally committed to you, but there may become a time in our relationship where that relationship is fragmented and maybe even severed because I will not walk with you in the path of self-destruction. And that is possible. And that's really quite tragic when that happens, but it does. I'm not punishing you because I now hate you and I don't love you anymore. It's that you are walking away from my capacity to love you. That's the difference. But it also says that that love rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Whew. Excited by the personal victories in other people's lives. When the prodigal son does show back up at home, what does the father say to him? About time. Boy, you owe me big time. Already gave away your inheritance to your brother. You might as well leave. You could be a slave in my house, I suppose. Now, he takes off his own robe. He takes off his signet ring. He gives this to the prodigal son. He says, I love you just as much today as I did when you left me. And he throws a party and he rejoices in the return of his son. We should rejoice in the real victories in other people's lives. When they're making the right kinds of decisions, that we need to come back and say, man, that's so cool that you've done that. That you've had that victory. Nice. Love endures through every circumstance. Namely, that love is a commitment that doesn't quit. We don't run out of love quotient in the lives of other people. Oh, we've already said this, but now we're saying it specifically. Now let's just bring ourselves to this last little category here. The species of attributes of real biblical love, not spiritual, not moral, but are in the realm of the emotional. That love is emotional. That it involves real emotional giving. Yeah, not just functionally giving, but emotionally giving. What does he say? Love is patient and kind. Love is not irritable. So love involves a certain softness, an approachability, a warmth. Yeah, that's right. It's very difficult, I think, for today's very mobile and busy families to think in terms of emotional warmth, approachability, and softness. We're so busy. Men are really kind of trained to turn off that sector of their brain. It's all about functioning. And the idea of warmth, yeah, I can be warm when I'm in love. But then, you know, then that begins to kind of, that feeling will fade, and what are we left with? You know, getting in touch with your one emotion, anger. We've got to understand that love is communication, and that communication needs to be expressed in emotional terms of really moving towards the other person. Are you the kind of person that others enjoy getting next to? Here's the question that I always have to keep coming back to in my own life. I have this legacy of people coming to me, or usually through somebody else. You know, so-and-so is really afraid of you. So-and-so is like intimidated to talk to you. So-and-so thinks that maybe you don't like them. Well, you know, sometimes that really irks me a lot. And I think, well, who do they think they are getting inside my head and understanding my motivations? On the other hand, I have to conclude, I really haven't given them much to go on, have I? So we've got to be able to have that warmth, that softness that enables us to project real enthusiasm about the life of another person. That's a real important part of love, that people will not experience love from us often without this dimension present. And then he says, and this I think is a great place to kind of bring this discussion to a close, this passage to a close. He says, love does not demand its own way. What is he saying here? He's saying that love is others-centered communication. Has someone close to you ever come up to say to you, you know, I wonder how if you really do love me? Maybe they won't say it that directly. Maybe they'll say instead, I feel ignored, I feel rejected, I feel like you don't care about me, that you're not thinking about me, stuff like that. Does that occur in your love life? Or is it just mine? Well, I say to myself and to others, mostly my wife, in those occasions, what do you mean? Don't you know that I work very hard to provide for this family? Haven't you seen all the things that I have done? I've taken out the trash. I've done the dishes. I cooked dinner last month. I'm doing these things. She says, I don't care about those things. You what? No, I want you to sit down and talk to me and relate to me, to spend time with me, to, you know, have a sensitive moment of real communication. Oh, that. And then I say, well, you know what I'd really like is for us not to have this sappy thing. But maybe we could go out to the backyard and put up that fence I've been trying to get together here for the last 2 years. And stuff like that. And what are we doing? We're doing this. Love is other people's other-centered communication. It's not message sent that matters, it's message received. Message received. What are they hearing? And it's really important for us to be effective lovers that we understand how people feel that sense of being deeply loved, accepted, appreciated, valued, and so forth. And we ought to conclude, or we ought to begin with the assumption that the way that they understand that's not necessarily the same way I do. So I'm going to need to really be a good student of the people that I love so that I can begin to approach them in ways that do connect with them. And that's an important aspect of love, and it involves the emotion. So many things that we could be saying here tonight about love. It is so central. It is the Bible's message. But here I just think are some things for us to reflect upon, to consider. And in closing, just two quick thoughts. One is that love is not hard. It is impossible. And I can't do it, and you can't do it. And it's the demands of love that drive us to a deeper need to draw our life from Christ. And that's why love and real spirituality are just absolutely tied together. If I set out to love the unlovely with all my imperfections, I'm not going to get very far on my own. It requires that I seek God's wisdom out through His Word so that I understand people, so that I can understand what to give. It means that I'm laboring in prayer on their behalf because I don't understand them. God does. And that I'm consciously saying, God, help me. Give me that insight. Give me the endurance. Give me what I need to stay in the fight of loving this person. And when we are living like this, our lives change. Our priorities change. What's important to us changes. And we find that we're not all about me. That we really have become a different kind of person. Love is the true measure of true spirituality. Where are you at with that tonight? Your spirituality is tied to your capacities for love. And it's where we find ourselves with those deep and sometimes paralyzing weaknesses that we see the real priorities of God and His work in our lives. It really sets for us the roadmap for what God is really interested in building into our lives. It's not a matter of where you are tonight. We're at various places in our capacity to love, our experience of love. We're not going to be perfect in this life. We can be substantially healed, and we can really become profoundly different people. Absolutely. It's a question of where am I heading, not where am I now. And my hope for us tonight here is that we would together say, man, where I want to be heading is to be a kind of person who demonstrates the reality of God through the love that I'm able to demonstrate in concrete relationships with people around me. That's true spirituality. God's will for your life. All right. Some things to think about there. All right. Let's go to prayer. Praise God that we are not left to stake our hope for love in other people, that we can find that in you. And that having found that, God, that you are able to transform us into people who can experience love and real joy in relationships because we're not a threat to the other, because we're prepared to lay down our lives for them. And that just opens the floodgates for real intimacy, real warmth, real significance in our relationships. And very importantly, God, I just would pray that as your word says, that the world will know that you sent Christ because of the love that Christians have for one another. I just wonder sometimes how good our communication is. But we see that an awful lot rides on this. God, I pray that you would just impress upon us that this is the central issue in our lives and in our witness, is how are we cooperating with you to become the kind of lovers of people that you are. And just as simple as that is, God, we just recognize how penetrating that is, how completely unequipped and unable we are to do that. And so we turn to you, Lord, and just asking you to change us, to make us the person who reflects who you really are. Just thinks that that's a cool way of looking at our spiritual growth, not as a bunch of rules, not as a list, not as some attained experience, but just as a person who responds to your love and becomes increasingly the kind of person who's able to really pour that into other people. So thanks for that, God, and lift up our evening of fellowship in your name. Amen.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.